Chapter 55. Brought to light by sending false letters to disaffected people, inviting them to join in pretended plots, which they too readily did. But one great real plot was at length discovered, and it ended the career of Mary, Queen of Scots. A seminary priest named Ballard, and a Spanish soldier named Savage, set on and encouraged by certain French priests, imparted a design to one Anthony Babington, a gentleman of fortune in Derbyshire, who had been for some time a secret agent of Mary's for murdering the Queen. Babington then confided the scheme to some other Catholic gentlemen who were his friends, and they joined in it heartily. They were vain, weak-headed young men, ridiculously confident, and preposterously proud of their plan, for they got a gimcrack painting made of the six choice spirits who were to murder Elizabeth, with Babington in an attitude for the center figure. Two of their number, however, one of whom was a priest, kept Elizabeth's wisest minister, Sir Francis Walsingham, acquainted with the whole project from the first. The conspirators were completely deceived to the final point, when Babington gave Savage, because he was shabby, a ring from his finger, and some money from his purse, wherewith to buy himself new clothes in which to kill the Queen. Walsingham, having then full evidence against the whole band, and two letters of Mary's besides, resolved to seize them. Suspecting something wrong, they stole out of the city, one by one, and hid themselves in St. John's Wood, and other places which really were hiding places then. But they were all taken, and all executed. When they were seized, a gentleman was sent from court to inform Mary of the fact, and of her being involved in the discovery. Her friends have complained that she was kept in very hard and severe custody. It does not appear very likely, for she was going out a hunting that very morning. Queen Elizabeth had been warned long ago, by one in France who had good information of what was secretly doing, that in holding Mary alive, she held the wolf who would devour her. Apostrophe the Bishop of London had, more lately, given the Queen's favorite minister the advice in writing, forthwith to cut off the Scottish Queen's head. Apostrophe the question now was, what to do with her. The Earl of Leicester wrote a little note home from Holland, recommending that she should be quietly poisoned. That noble favorite having accustomed his mind, it is possible, to remedies of that nature. His black advice, however, was disregarded, and she was brought to trial at Fotheringay Castle in Northamptonshire, before a tribunal of 40, composed of both religions. There, and in the Star Chamber at Westminster, the trial lasted a fortnight. She defended herself with great ability, but could only deny the confessions that had been made by Babington and others, could only call her own letters, produced against her by her own secretaries, forgeries, and, in short, could only deny everything. She was found guilty, and declared to have incurred the penalty of death. The Parliament met, approved the sentence, and prayed the Queen to have it executed. The Queen replied that she requested them to consider whether no means could be found of saving Mary's life without endangering her own. The Parliament rejoined, no, and the citizens illuminated their houses and lighted bonfires, in token of their joy that all these plots and troubles were to be ended by the death of the Queen of Scots. She, feeling sure that her time was now come, wrote a letter to the Queen of England, making three entreaties. First, that she might be buried in France. Secondly, that she might not be executed in secret, but before her servants and some others. Thirdly, that after her death, her servants should not be molested, but should be suffered to go home with the legacies she left them. It was an affecting letter, and Elizabeth shed tears over it, but sent no answer. Then came a special ambassador from France, and another from Scotland, to intercede for Mary's life, and then the nation began to clamor, more and more, for her death. What the real feelings or intentions of Elizabeth were, can never be known now, but I strongly suspect her of only wishing one thing more than Mary's death, and that was to keep free of the blame of it. On the 1st of February, 1587, Lord Burleigh having drawn out the warrant for the execution, the Queen sent to the Secretary Davison to bring it to her, that she might sign it, which she did. Next day, when Davison told her it was sealed, she angrily asked him why such haste was necessary. Next day but one, she joked about it, and swore a little. Again, next day but one, she seemed to complain that it was not yet done, but still she would not be plain with those about her. So, on the 7th, the Earls of Kent and Shrewsbury, with the Sheriff of Northamptonshire, came with the warrant to Fotheringay, to tell the Queen of Scots to prepare for death. When those messengers of ill omen were gone, Mary made a frugal supper, drank to her servants, read over her will, went to bed, slept for some hours, and then arose and passed the remainder of the night saying prayers. In the morning she dressed herself in her best clothes, and, at 8 o'clock when the sheriff came for her to her chapel, took leave of her servants who were there assembled praying with her, and went downstairs, carrying a Bible in one hand, and a crucifix in the other. Two of her women and four of her men were allowed to be present in the hall, where a low scaffold, only 2 feet from the ground, was erected and covered with black, and where the executioner from the tower, and his assistant, stood, dressed in black velvet. The hall was full of people. While the sentence was being read she sat upon a stool, and, when it was finished, she again denied her guilt, as she had done before. The Earl of Kent and the Dean of Peterborough, in their Protestant zeal, made some very unnecessary speeches to her, to which she replied that she died in the Catholic religion, and they need not trouble themselves about that matter. When her head and neck were uncovered by the executioners, she said that she had not been used to be undressed by such hands, or before so much company. Finally, one of her women fastened a cloth over her face, and she laid her neck upon the block, and repeated more than once in Latin, "Into thy hands, O Lord, I commend my spirit." Some say her head was struck off in 2 blows, some say in 3. However that be, when it was held up, streaming with blood, the real hair beneath the false hair she had long worn was seen to be as gray as that of a woman of 70, though she was at that time only in her 46th year. All her beauty was gone. But she was beautiful enough to her little dog, who cowered under her dress, frightened, when she went upon the scaffold, and who lay down beside her headless body, when all her earthly sorrows were over. Third part, on its being formally made known to Elizabeth, that the sentence had been executed on the Queen of Scots, she showed the utmost grief and rage, drove her favorites from her with violent indignation, and sent Davison to the Tower, from which place he was only released in the end, by paying an immense fine which completely ruined him. Elizabeth not only overacted her part in making these pretenses, but most basely reduced to poverty one of her faithful servants for no other fault than obeying her commands. James, King of Scotland, Mary's son, made a show likewise of being very angry on the occasion, but he was a pensioner of England to the amount of £5,000 a year, and he had known very little of his mother, and he possibly regarded her as the murderer of his father, and he soon took it quietly. Philip, King of Spain, however, threatened to do greater things than ever had been done yet, to set up the Catholic religion and punish Protestant England. Elizabeth, hearing that he and the Prince of Parma were making great preparations for this purpose, in order to be beforehand with them, sent out Admiral Drake, a famous navigator, who had sailed about the world, and had already brought great plunder from Spain, to the port of Cadiz, where he burned 100 vessels full of stores. This great loss obliged the Spaniards to put off the invasion for a year. But it was nonetheless formidable for that, amounting to 130 ships, 19,000 soldiers, 8,000 sailors, 2,000 slaves, and between 2,000 and 3,000 great guns. England was not idle in making ready to resist this great force. All the men between 16 years old and 60 were trained and drilled. The national fleet of ships, in number only 34 at first, was enlarged by public contributions, and by private ships, fitted out by noblemen. The city of London, of its own accord, furnished double the number of ships and men that it was required to provide. And, if ever the national spirit was up in England, it was up all through the country to resist the Spaniards. Some of the Queen's advisers were for seizing the principal English Catholics, and putting them to death. But the Queen, who, to her honor, used to say that she would never believe any ill of her subjects, which a parent would not believe of her own children, rejected the advice, and only confined a few of those who were the most suspected, in the Fens in Lincolnshire. The great body of Catholics deserved this confidence, for they behaved most loyally, nobly, and bravely. So, with all England firing up like one strong angry man, and with both sides of the Thames fortified, and with the soldiers under arms, and with the sailors in their ships, the country waited for the coming of the proud Spanish fleet, which was called the Invincible Armada. The Queen herself, riding in armor on a white horse, and the Earl of Essex and the Earl of Leicester holding her bridle rein, made a brave speech to the troops at Tilbury Fort opposite Gravesend, which was received with such enthusiasm as is seldom known. Then came the Spanish Armada into the English Channel, sailing along in the form of a half-moon, of such great size, that it was 7 miles broad. But the English were quickly upon it, and woe then to all the Spanish ships that dropped a little out of the half-moon, for the English took them instantly. And it soon appeared that the great armada was anything but invincible, for on a summer night, bold Drake sent 8 blazing fire ships right into the midst of it. In terrible consternation the Spaniards tried to get out to sea, and so became dispersed. The English pursued them at a great advantage. A storm came on, and drove the Spaniards among rocks and shoals, and the swift end of the Invincible fleet was, that it lost 30 great ships and 10,000 men, and, defeated and disgraced, sailed home again. Being afraid to go by the English Channel, it sailed all round Scotland and Ireland. Some of the ships getting cast away on the latter coast in bad weather, the Irish, who were a kind of savages, plundered those vessels, and killed their crews. So ended this great attempt to invade and conquer England. And I think it will be a long time before any other invincible fleet coming to England with the same object will fare much better than the Spanish Armada. Though the Spanish king had had this bitter taste of English bravery, he was so little the wiser for it, as still to entertain his old designs, and even to conceive the absurd idea of placing his daughter on the English throne. But the Earl of Essex, Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Thomas Howard, and some other distinguished leaders, put to sea from Plymouth, entered the port of Cadiz once more, obtained a complete victory over the shipping assembled there, and got possession of the town. In obedience to the Queen's express instructions, they behaved with great humanity, and the principal loss of the Spaniards was a vast sum of money which they had to pay for ransom. This was one of many gallant achievements on the sea, effected in this reign. Sir Walter Raleigh himself, after marrying a maid of honor and giving offense to the maiden queen thereby, had already sailed to South America in search of gold. The Earl of Leicester was now dead, and so was Sir Thomas Walsingham, whom Lord Burleigh was soon to follow. The principal favorite was the Earl of Essex, a spirited and handsome man, a favorite with the people too as well as with the Queen, and possessed of many admirable qualities. It was much debated at court whether there should be peace with Spain or no, and he was very urgent for war. He also tried hard to have his own way in the appointment of a deputy to govern in Ireland. One day, while this question was in dispute, he hastily took offense, and turned his back upon the Queen, As a gentle reminder of which impropriety, the queen gave him a tremendous box on the ear, and told him to go to the devil. He went home instead, and did not reappear at court for half a year or so, when he and the queen were reconciled, though never, as some suppose, thoroughly. From this time the fate of the Earl of Essex, and that of the queen seemed to be blended together. The Irish were still perpetually quarreling and fighting among themselves, and he went over to Ireland as Lord Lieutenant, to the great joy of his enemies, Sir Walter Raleigh among the rest, who were glad to have so dangerous a rival far off. Not being by any means successful there, and knowing that his enemies would take advantage of that circumstance to injure him with the queen, he came home again, though against her orders. The queen being taken by surprise, when he appeared before her, gave him her hand to kiss, and he was overjoyed, though it was not a very lovely hand by this time, but in the course of the same day she ordered him to confine himself to his room, and 2 or 3 days afterwards had him taken into custody. With the same sort of caprice, and as capricious an old woman she now was, as ever wore a crown or a head either, she sent him broth from her own table on his falling ill from anxiety, and cried about him. He was a man who could find comfort and occupation in his books, and he did so for a time, not the least happy time, I dare say, of his life. But it happened unfortunately for him, that he held a monopoly in sweet wines, which means that nobody could sell them without purchasing his permission. This right, which was only for a term, expiring, he applied to have it renewed. The queen refused, with the rather strong observation, but she did make strong observations, that an unruly beast must be stinted in his food. Upon this, the angry earl, who had been already deprived of many offices, thought himself in danger of complete ruin, and turned against the queen, whom he called a vain old woman who had grown as crooked in her mind as she had in her figure. These uncomplimentary expressions the ladies of the court immediately snapped up and carried to the queen, whom they did not put in a better temper, you may believe. The same court ladies, when they had beautiful dark hair of their own, used to wear false red hair, to be like the queen. So they were not very high-spirited ladies, however high in rank. The worst object of the Earl of Essex, and some friends of his who used to meet at Lord Southampton's house, was to obtain possession of the queen, and oblige her by force, to dismiss her ministers and change her favorites. On Saturday the 7th of February, 1601, the council suspecting this, summoned the Earl to come before them. He, pretending to be ill, declined. It was then settled among his friends, that as the next day would be Sunday, when many of the citizens usually assembled at the cross by St. Paul's Cathedral, he should make one bold effort, to induce them to rise and follow him to the palace. So, on the Sunday morning, he and a small body of adherents started out of his house, Essex House, by the Strand, with steps to the river, having first shut up in it, as prisoners, some members of the council who came to examine him, and hurried into the city with the Earl at their head, crying out, "For the Queen! For the Queen! A plot is laid for my life!" Apostrophe No one heeded them, however, and when they came to St. Paul's there were no citizens there. In the meantime the prisoners at Essex House had been released by one of the Earl's own friends. He had been promptly proclaimed a traitor in the city itself, and the streets were barricaded with carts and guarded by soldiers. The Earl got back to his house by water, with difficulty, and after an attempt to defend his house against the troops and cannon by which it was soon surrounded, gave himself up that night. He was brought to trial on the 19th, and found guilty. On the 25th, he was executed on Tower Hill, where he died, at 34 years old, both courageously and penitently. His stepfather suffered with him. His enemy, Sir Walter Raleigh, stood near the scaffold all the time, but not so near it as we shall see him stand, before we finish his history. In this case, as in the cases of the Duke of Norfolk and Mary Queen of Scots, the Queen had commanded, and countermanded, and again commanded, the execution. It is probable that the death of her young and gallant favorite in the prime of his good qualities was never off her mind afterwards, but she held out the same vein. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.